We recording?
Yeah, it's recording.
Okay, great. So our first question is, in what sense is time not like a river? And in what sense is it like a river?
Yeah. So maybe you all have heard probably, some of you I wouldn't doubt are probably familiar with this old river metaphor, right? That we tend to get about time as it flows like a river. You never step into it in the same place.
Yeah.
Right? That's the old classic Heraclitus idea of time being a river. It passes or flows by, right? We have that sort of a notion. But the river, we shouldn't forget, is external to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does suggest that there are events out in the world independent of us, in the same way that time might be, so that it flows. And where sometimes we step in it somehow, or that we're amidst it, you know, as if we're, you know, as the river flows, you know.
Yeah. The time-space continuum.
Yes, that's right. The time-space continuum.
Yeah.
We are in it. And so it does suggest that. And so it's somehow in and of itself, events move for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just, I don't
observers.
Know. Observers.
Of time.
Of time. Yeah. And he does suggest here, I think that's interesting, he said, well, when we use those metaphors a lot of times, we tend to forget that we're also somehow, as he says, surreptitiously putting a witness, right, in there. So it's right. As if you thought, okay, well, you can say that the river flows on by, but yeah. Who sees the river flow on by?
Right.
Someone has to.
Yeah, and is the person on the shore looking at the river flow by? Or is the person on a boat going with the river? Because those two people are going to experience the flow of the river differently.
Differently. Or are they in a pair of hip waders?
Yeah.
In the river.
Yeah. Fishing. Fly fishing.
Fly fishing.
Yeah. You fly fish, Pete?
No. No. Okay. No. I'm just an old-fashioned, you know, if I did fish, I used to fish some, and if I was a fish guy, I was always more or less just a good old-fashioned rod and reel.
Rod and reel.
You know, just chuck it on out there and reel it back, you know.
Maybe something to bite. None of this weird dancing.
Dancing stuff. It looks like it's hard to cast, and then you make your own flies, and it's some sort of weird fetishism.
Yeah.
Fly fetishism.
Yeah. So maybe one good place to point out is just the that the river metaphor really suggests that the past drives the present into being.
Yeah, like
causally. Yeah.
Yep.
Like and Merleau-Ponty says, now from the, this is on page 434, 473 in the French.
Yep.
Now from the moment I introduce the observer, depending on whether he follows the flow of the river or whether he observes its passage from the riverbank, the temporal relations are reversed. In the second case, the masses of water that have already gone by do not head toward the future. If you're on the bank, they don't head toward the future. They sink into the past. The still to come is on the side of the source. And time does not come from the past. The past does not drive the present into being, nor does the present drive the future into being. The future is not prepared behind the observer. It is planned out in front of him, like the storm on the horizon.
Here it comes.
If the observer is now placed in a boat and follows the current, it can certainly be said that he descends with it toward his future, but the future is in those landscapes that await him at the estuary, and the flow of time is no longer the stream itself, but is rather the unfolding of landscapes for the moving observer. So what he seems to be pointing out is that depending on where you're standing, the flow of the river changes its orientation and its function as a metaphor for time. And that means the river itself isn't a stable metaphor for time at all. It implies a very specific position. That is, the metaphor probably implies being in and flowing with the river. But even then, because that would make the flow of the river forward flowing into the future, which seems like is what they want to say. But even then, when you're in the river flowing with it, it's not the river that's changing, it's the landscape. So the river doesn't actually give a good metaphor for the like future events. Because actually the river just keeps on being the same pressure of water flowing. It keeps on just being cold and wet and like a river. And so it's like the river is like the eternal present that you can never escape.
Yeah.
Not the, yeah, so.
Because when I always think of that metaphor, I do always think of it in the sort of Heraclitus sense of stepping into it,
mm-hmm.
but never in the same place because it flows on by.
Right.
And so my sense of it's always been like a sort of stationary observer in one place.
Yep.
Who steps into it, but it flows by. Yep. And so this was actually a neat surprise for me. He says, well, what if I was on a boat in the river? It was moving on by. I was like, oh yeah, cool. I've never really thought. He kind of brings this up later with the train metaphor, right? You see the attendant on the, at the station as you're going by in the train, but the landscape isn't moving. The attendant goes, oh, where'd he go? Because you move on by him, right? But the mountain's still stable in the background.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what he's effectively saying is that there isn't, there can't be some metaphor of time that's independent of the experience of it.
Right.
Just can't be.
Because what the metaphor of time being like a river is doing is it's objectifying time.
That's right.
It's making time sound like it's out there.
Yep.
Something we could step into.
Yep.
Something that we could, be caught up in that pre-exists us.
And it's like being pushed forward into the future. Right, but it's not, that doesn't begin to describe how it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah.
There is a sense in which we can say that time has a flow.
Right. And there is a way in which we can say that it is like a river.
Yes.
Because when we get to the fountain example, quite a few pages later on 445.
Yeah, it's way on out there.
484 in the French. We say that there is a time, just as we say that there is a fountain. Yeah. The water changes and the fountain remains because the form is preserved, right? Remember, we've now learned that time is a certain kind of style.
Not dissimilar from gestural,
right? Holds time is something in the way that it has a certain way about it, but not in the sense that it is some kind of external independent object. It's a certain existential style or a certain feature of being in the world.
Yeah.
A feature is maybe too casual. It is our being in the world. It's the manner of our being in the world.
Yeah. So it's our way of holding past and future.
Right.
Or our hold on it. As we move, right, with our projects.
It's that our having something that you're doing in the present, whether it's cleaning out your gutters or making some coffee, or whatever.
Or cleaning your face, like Timo is right now.
Yeah, cleaning your face. Or something that we would understand as being broader in character, like going to school.
Yeah.
Which is going to be something that's going to happen for over a number of years. When you're engaged in a project, everything you do in the present presupposes a horizon of the past and the future. It's just impossible to have a behavior, to gesture, to intend, to have a project. It's impossible to do any of those things without the double horizon of the past and the future.
And it's, remember, you're not explicitly represent. You can explicitly represent it to yourself, and you can do that, but you're not doing it here. This is, again, pre-objective, non-thetic consciousness.
Yeah. When you sit down and read Merleau-Ponty for this class, you are anticipating graduating without explicitly anticipating graduating.
That's right.
You know, the person who isn't holding themselves toward that intentional project in the same way, maybe isn't doing it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's probably a person who's in college, who someone made them go to college, who is not really particularly thinking about graduation or really cares whether they graduate or don't. And it's probably reflected in their behavior.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
No. Style, attitude.
Yeah. So the fountain has a certain form. It has a certain shape, just like the temporal horizons give a certain kind of shape or character.
Structurings.
So the fountain remains because the form is preserved. And the form is preserved because each successive burst takes up the functions of the previous one. And now I'm going to jump ahead.
Yeah.
Here is where the river metaphor is justified. Not insofar as the river flows, but insofar as it is one with itself.
Yes.
It has one style. It has one form. It's a kind. It's a kind of unity. Mm-hmm. As much as it is also a kind of transcendence.
And in much the same way that we describe the motion of an object through space.
Right. Exactly.
Not a succession of nows and instants.
No.
Right. But the
toward the ground.
Yeah.
That the object has as soon as it's released from your hand.
Yeah.
It becomes its vector.
Yeah.
And its future and its past. I mean, you couldn't be up at that point in the air if you hadn't been thrown a second ago. And if you weren't heading toward the ground a couple seconds from now. That position at the height of its arc tells the whole story and cannot be separated from any other part of it.
Yeah.
Just like the fountain, if you put a gap in there, he says, the whole thing breaks apart.
Yeah, it's not in time anymore. And so you can't describe it as a succession of nows.
No. Yeah. The fountain is one thing.
Yeah. Much one, like a river is one.
One.
Flow.
And so in that sense, time is like a river insofar as it's one, but then it's also like a tree or like a toaster or like anything that's one with itself.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So in a way, the time as river metaphor is not really more accurate than almost anything you could come up with.
Yeah.
But it does have a sense if what you mean is the river, though it's changing, continues to be itself. That gets us a little closer.
Yeah. That's pretty good on the river.
Yeah. Shall we move on to our next question?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah.
This jealous. One I liked.
Yeah. So why don't you take us?
Okay, I'll take us into this one. So what is Merleau-Ponty's show?
Yeah.
By using the example in the novel of Swann's jealousy, right? Or let me rephrase that in a better syntax. What does Merleau-Ponty show us, right, by the example of Swann's jealousy in Proust's novel?
Yeah.
And this is in section J, entitled Temporality as Self-Affection of Itself. And maybe this is a place to just sort of read it. And Andy and I were talking about this before. It's interesting. He loves Proust. And This is the one place where he's just like, no, Proust didn't get this right.
Yeah.
And so, but let's just go ahead and look at it. Page 449 at the top. So French 488, that section. Let's just go ahead and start there at the top. The novelist or the psychologist who does not return to the sources. Remember, that's what he's always. Turn to the sources, right? And yeah. Who accepts temporalization as ready-made, like the river, out there, ready-made, right? Sees consciousness as a multiplicity of psychic facts between which he attempts to establish causal relations. So it's as if each event makes up a sort of psychic fact impressed upon our minds or our memories, right? In some sort of way that we then connect later according to cause and effect.
Like, as we'll see, first I was in love, then I got jealous.
Yeah, exactly. So Proust, for example, shows how Swann's love for Odette brings with it, he says, the jealousy that in turn modifies this love. Since Swann, obsessed with tearing her away from every rival, loses the luxury of admiring Odette. You've probably experienced people like this, right? You know, people who get the jealous type, right? Who try to shed off every single potential rival for anyone, you know, to love the person to whom they are jealous of. In fact, Swann's consciousness is not an inert milieu where psychical facts solicit each other externally. There is no jealousy provoked by the love that responds by altering that love. Rather, there is a certain manner, love that style, right? Certain manner of loving in which the entire destiny of this love can be instantly seen. Swann has a taste for Odette's person and for this spectacle that she is, for this way that she has of glancing, of forming a smile, and of modulating her voice. Jeez, come on, man. But what is it to have a taste for someone? Proust answers with regard to another love. It is to feel excluded from this life and to desire to enter and to occupy it completely. Swann's love does not give rise to jealousy. It is already jealous and has been since its beginning. Jealousy does not bring about a modification of love, for the pleasure Swann takes in gazing upon Odette carries with it its own alteration, since it was the pleasure of being the only one to do so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you could say, oh, well, she did this, then it made him jealous, then he thought this, and then it made him more jealous, and then then this person was there, and that made him jealous, and then she did this, and it made me jealous.
These are the stories we tell about ourselves.
Yeah. Over and over and over again. Right?
Such and such happened, and then I changed to be this kind of person.
Yeah.
Not such and such happened, which made more explicit a style that was already going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you, I was just thinking about this phrase. I was thinking about how we could unpack it. Why do you do this to me? Well, it doesn't suggest somehow you've done this, then it my response is thus because it's this act or event that has made me do this and then done this and then done that. In some causal sequence that we put together after the fact. Right, but it's from the beginning, right? His love for her was a jealous love, and it's every time, right, he's with her. That jealousy appears in, as he says, the certain manner of loving.
Yep.
Right, as they take apart.
You know, it's just like how a tadpole is going to be a frog. But it don't look like a frog.
No.
So like this manner of this thing that he calls love, it's actually jealousy. Once you feed it enough and it gets full grown,
yeah,
it'll be obvious that it's jealousy.
Yeah.
But it looks like love at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is, in a sense, already jealous because, you know, it was, he was the pleasure of, it was because it began with him having the pleasure of being the only one to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that just sort of just go. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't grow, you see what I mean? But it's not, we don't want to say that that growth occurs in sort of discrete causal stages.
Right.
Right.
Just like we don't want to say that the fountain was,
exactly,
you know, something that emerged out of a sort of out of discrete parts or movements. Just like we don't want to say when you throw the rock that it was at T1, then it's at T2, then it's at T3.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to talk about holes as if they were just collections of parts.
Yeah.
And causality, Merleau-Ponty, I think, is showing us, is a way of talking about holes artificially broken up into parts.
Yeah. It's just classic empirical objectification of reality.
Yep.
That's all it is.
Yep.
We can talk about it that way if we want, but we can never experience it that way because it doesn't make any sense. And if we were to experience it that way, we could only say that we weren't any longer really talking about time.
Yeah.
Because it can't be in time.
Yeah.
If that's the way that we conceive of it.
And so a person's feelings of love can't really legitimately be separated from any of their other feelings or thoughts. It's just part of the existential style as a whole.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna find that you can like discreetly separate parts of yourself out such that like one part could cause another part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like a part of the fountain doesn't cause another part of the fountain to move.
No.
As a whole.
Yeah. There's the instinct, there's the always the instantaneous whole of my being.
Right.
Which I am in.
Yeah.
And that does partake of a past and a future, but it's a very, very specific way that he's understanding that thing, right? Because we don't want to make the mistake, right, of thinking that a past is out there and a future is out there and that they work in a sequence and along a linear.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, that's going to be a mistake. But I have a sense of a past and a future, right?
Yeah.
In my intentions and my, right, my projects.
Yeah. I mean, if we say that the tadpole becomes a frog because it's always been a frog, that's very different than when we say the tadpole becomes a frog because there is a chemical reaction in its cells.
Yeah.
That cause such and such shift to occur. Because then we're talking about the tadpole as if it's the contingent result of objective processes, instead of talking about the frog as an individual existence with a certain style that's present in its tadpoleness and in its mature frogginess.
And to say that somehow it would be silly to say, to sort of peel everything away and say, well, that we can only describe the frog and its frogness and its nowness as right. if it was never a tadpole. That would be
right.
bizarre.
Yeah.
But we can't describe it in some sort of causal, right, sequence at the same
time. No, we can make a developmental sequence, but the thing that rules the sequence is the form
yeah.
of the frog. I mean, it's the destiny, let's call it, of the yeah. frog. That at no time was this tadpole directed toward any other future than frog. I mean, it is a frog already, but
yeah.
like the form of a mature frog, you know, it's there. And so, you know, we see this with humans, the way in which sometimes child a childishness flashes in an adult, or an adult-likeness flashes in a child.
Yeah.
They're not like causally separated.
Yeah.
And they're in fact just like past and future are just different emphases. Cats are going crazy.
Good.
Just almost knocked something over. yeah, they're just like, they're different ways of emphasizing an intentional project, aspects of an intentional project.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like separate beings.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. It's tricky, isn't it? Because, for me, I wanted there to be this sort of pure ideality of time.
Yeah.
Divorced from the external notion of time having a reality independent of me. And I wanted time to be something that I do exclusively, right? Or some sort of, I guess, species or feeling of being in the world so particular and unique that it almost feels like eternity, which is not false, right? But to exclude that from the feeling of there being a past and a future excludes a whole lot. Well, it just doesn't allow us to be in the world anymore.
Right. As soon as you become aware of the present as present and name it as such,
that's it. Yeah,
you're already bringing in future and past.
Yeah, because
you can't name a present without naming at the same time where it's come from and where it's going.
And that's what he gets at when we earlier in the chapter when he talks about Augustine and Leibniz,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they're doing something kind of like that, but with external things.
Right.
But you can see how you could do it for an individual consciousness just as well.
Right.
You could say, if I can just whittle everything down to an immediate present.
Yeah.
Exclusive of a past and future, because those are just fictions that can't be.
Right.
But that doesn't explain what it's like to be in the world at all.
Right. Yeah. Similarly, we could talk about something the students are probably even more familiar with than they are with Augustine and Leibniz.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, fair enough.
No. You're bringing up what Merleau-Ponty brings up.
Yeah, he brings it up. Yeah.
And it's helpful to like say this is where those thoughts fit. But you know, like the resurgence of mindfulness is interesting because everybody now just quotes blithely that you should be in the present, as if there was a way to be in the present that excluded the past and the future. That is ridiculous.
Yeah, just try to and be present, man. Just try
it
to
doesn't
be
make
present.
Any sense because what would make more sense is to say we need to shift the nature of our intentional projects because our intentional projects are too heavily weighted toward their outcomes and not heavily weighted enough toward the joy of doing them.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Right? Yeah, that would be the better way to describe it. But we use this temporal signification, I guess we want to call it, to describe it. Say, hey man, just try
be
to
be present.
Be present, man.
Yeah.
Be present. Yeah.
And I'm sure that when you've heard this, whether you made this explicit to yourself or not, didn't you ever have the thought, how could I be anything else?
Yeah. Wouldn't that be weird?
When have I ever not been present?
Yeah.
Right. And then they'd be like, oh, but I mean like in your thoughts, you're somewhere else. Be here now. Like in this place.
What does that even mean?
Yeah. What does that even mean? Like if there's no such thing as thoughts, you know, not really. If there's no inner life, as we've been arguing with Merleau-Ponty, then that whole language doesn't quite make sense. I mean, I think they're on to something. I actually think mindfulness is healthy. I support it generally as a practice. But I think the language that's used to describe it is, let's just say, loose and potentially vague. And what Merleau-Ponty is showing us here is that It's not about being in the present. It's about how every act tells a story about past, present, and future, because every behavior or every activity has a temporal value or a temporal signification through which we recognize it and understand it.
Yeah.
If you couldn't see the future, I mean, that's another thing we say that's, again, false. We say things like, I can't predict the future. Oh, God, that's all we do. Like, you couldn't, if you couldn't act, I mean, if you couldn't predict the future, you wouldn't be able to act. Of course you're predicting the future. But that's the thing. You're not predicting the future of, like, objective time. All you're doing is saying, I see the wholeness of this act. I see that tadpoles are frogs. Or I see that people who pass their classes get degrees. Or, you know, I see that people who climb slippery ladders fall.
Yeah. I see this style in my intentions.
Right.
And that's the future.
Yeah.
But we like to think, I've even been watching this show on the FX channel, and I've been so frustrated by it. It's called Devs, and it's about a sort of Silicon Valley jerk who's a total determinist and believes that somehow they can come up with an algorithm that's going to predict the quote-unquote future.
Yeah.
It's absurd. You know what I mean? You know.
Oh, man. Don't get Merleau Ponty started in time travel shows.
Oh, my God. Don't even get it going. Because, I mean, there's so much conceptual looseness and imprecision with it.
Yeah.
At least some of the characters who are the heroes, actually, of the show do think that those people are nuts. So that's at least something.
Yeah.
But there is this notion that somehow, oh, well, if we just had enough variables from an objective, quote-unquote, past and information, then we could somehow predict, quote-unquote, a future.
Yeah, but if science is just making explicit things that were already acquired in a non-thetic way, at its best, you know, we're never going to get a scientific world that's actually radically different or more informed than the world of common sense, because our perception has already told us all the things that we can learn about the world without making them explicit. And all we can do in philosophy classes and science classes and reading novels and, you know, running experiments, all we can do is learn how to make the things we already know in a way more explicit.
Yeah. And can anyone, from what
perspective? Crack the code.
Yeah. Crack the code, man.
Yeah.
The future.
Yeah.
And from what perspective would you do that?
Yeah.
I'd like to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if that would happen.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so, that was a stem winder, but it was fun.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We could get back to it, you know, like, I think this example is important to Merleau-Ponty.
It is.
Because it's like the fountain example, but now from the interior.
That's right.
It's saying internal states of feeling or consciousness are a single whole, just like the fountain is a single whole. And you can't say, first I was in love and then I was jealous, because our intentions already carry with them a certain kind of future. That does not mean determinism. That doesn't mean that, like, that Swan is destined to end up in a relationship or not in a relationship with Odette. Neither of those outcomes are determined. But he is destined to be jealous, because from the very beginning, that was the nature of his love. Whether Odette is the kind of person who wants to be with a jealous lover or not, and whether they end up together, that, like, it's not predetermined in any way.
No, because that would deny another basic thing about an essential for Merleau-Ponty, which is always the open, unfinished plenitude.
Right. Yeah.
Right? Of existence.
Right.
And that's what's inescapable.
So, yeah.
And time's no different.
Right.
It's just as unfinished and uncertain.
Yeah, absolutely unfinished.
Yeah.
But it's motivated rather than caused in the sense that it's the time is always just the unpacking of a certain style, not the interaction of heterogeneous substances on each other.
Yeah. Because if we were to say, yeah, that's right. Because if we were to say, if we were to say that, then we could talk about determinism.
Right.
If we were talking about causation, we could talk about determinism. But if we're talking about motivation, then we get back to the unfinished plenitude openness, right? Despite of its, in spite of it, or, you know, in a certain way, because of its being in time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being in time means you can never be outside of time.
Yeah.
And that means you can never be everywhere at once. And it also means you can never get ahead of the stage of the action that you're in. Mm-hmm. You can never, you know, you'll never be able to like make the thing that comes at the end come any earlier than the end of the act, right? So in that sense, the temporal structure is the saying is like just another way of talking about the structure of intentionality.
I love this. He uses one of those nice big long hyphenated things. Did you see that one on 443? Before that, he says temporality at the very bottom of the page. Temporality temporalizes itself as a, here's the big word, future that goes into the past by coming into the present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've got to hyphenate it. The reason why...
Got to hyphenate it, yeah.
That's like, that's just trying to do with words what the fountain does.
Exactly.
Which is to say all the parts are connected. Mm-hmm. So future, past, present, those are not discrete items that can be separated from each other and that can interact. Future, past, present are all moments of the same continuous act. Mm-hmm. And they are they're different ways of emphasizing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are not actually as distinct as we like to make them sound. The future is already here. The past is also here.
Yeah.
Like they're just here in a different way. And like Merleau-Ponty does some beautiful stuff, I think, toward the beginning when he's talking about how, you know, the day, like the evening is already present.
Yeah.
In his intention.
Like, yeah.
You know that it's going to get dark later. But have you ever found yourself needing to make it that explicit? I mean, very rarely are you like, let me remind you, Pete, it's going to get dark tonight.
Yeah,
thinking about that all day because I've made sure that I don't forget that, because if I don't remind myself that it's going to get dark, I could forget. You never forget that it's going to get dark. Mm-hmm. That's so deep down in there and in how you plan a day that it's like almost ridiculous to talk about it. And yet, that's the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's acting on me and every decision I make all the time.
That's nice.
All day long.
Yeah, that's really nice. Yeah.
It's
just a really good concrete example of how it's felt.
Yeah.
Sensed. Yeah. That's good stuff. Okay. Well, actually, that leads us into the third question, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. I just want to point out where I think I'm getting this stuff from.
Oh, yeah.
Page 439.
Yeah.
When he says, the day weighs upon me with all of its weight.
Yeah, that was really good. Yeah, that's
I do not recall any particular detail, but I have the imminent power of doing so. I still have it in hand.
Yeah, still
in Similarly, hand. I do not think about the evening that is about to arrive, nor of what it will entail, and yet it is there. Just as the back of the house.
The back of the house. The back of the lamp, the back of the house, the thing we've been talking about. My body's phenomenal.
Right.
A phenomenal body.
So to admit that there's a past and a future is just to admit the unfinished character of our being present in the world.
There you go.
And in that sense, to admit that there is time is just to admit that there is me.
Yeah.
And my, and more, and even more, to admit that there is a point of view on the world that I call mine.
Me. For mine.
Yeah, that I call me. Right, so the third question.
Yeah. So what does it mean to call time a transitional synthesis?
Tricky.
It's tricky, and it, in some ways, it gets us back into a bit, some history of philosophy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, especially with Kant, you know, and stuff like that, in terms of, because that's a different kind of synthesis in the way that the intellectualists, as you remember all the way back to those folks, would understand that synthesis.
Right. I guess, would we say, am I right in assuming that the empiricists consider time a passive synthesis?
Yes.
The intellectualists consider time an active synthesis.
Something the mind does.
Yeah. It's a passive synthesis because it's something like matter does to us empiricists. Yeah. And so it's we're passive passengers. Time flows, carries us with it.
We have to be careful about the passive thing just because, anyway, we get into it later with Husserl and, that notion. But yeah, the empiricists would say it's a passive thing. Time happens to us as our objective bodies are affected by the passage of time in the world and its relations out there.
Right. And then for them, time is the time of decomposition in the body is no.
That's
different.
Exactly where I was headed, is the decomposing body. Yeah. Of the empiricist. Yeah.
Yeah. It's no different than the living body recomposing itself for them.
Yeah. It's aging.
Yeah. Yeah. Because everything's passive.
Yeah, everything's passive. Can't do anything about it.
But for the intellectualist, everything is active. So it's like you said, it's something the mind does. Time is produced by me.
Mm-hmm. In order to shape my reality as such.
Right. And I organize things according
to it. Yeah. Yeah.
But Merleau-Ponty argues with Husserl that it is neither a passive synthesis nor an active synthesis, but what they call a transitional.
Yeah, or synthesis of transition. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a transitional synthesis seems to be something that is combined out of activity and passivity, or out of immanence and transcendence.
Yeah, it's both.
It's both at once.
Yeah.
And it is not just both at once, it's the passage between them. And so that's the transition. It is a transition between what we call passive and what we call active. It links them and brings them together, but it also shows us that there's no true passivity or true activity, like just as such, because they're both caught up in the transition.
Yeah, he really gets rolling. I mean, I don't know. This is, the section on passivity and activity.
Yeah.
Way toward the end there. Mm-hmm. Section K.
Okay.
Right? I mean, that's where he's most explicit about that.
Yeah.
He's okay. Well, and this is where passive synthesis gets a little confusing, because he uses it in a different sort of way. He said we provisionally call it this. Mm-hmm. because he doesn't mean passive in the passive sense of the empiricist, right, mm-hmm. notion. So maybe we could start with on 451, a passive synthesis would be contradictory if. Mm-hmm. So a passive synthesis would be contradictory if synthesis means composition.
Mm-hmm.
And if passivity consists in receiving a multiplicity rather than composing it. If mm-hmm. synthesis means composition, the mind composes it, puts it together, right? If it means composition. If passivity consists in receiving a multiplicity,
mm-hmm.
right? Passive receptor, right? Rather than composing it. We meant in speaking of a passive synthesis that the multiple, this is interesting, is penetrated by us.
Mm-hmm.
And that nevertheless, we are not the ones who perform the synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you see, that's so tricky, but I mean that it's really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
The multiple, as in the sense of there is a now, a present, a purity to that present, that can neither, in a certain way, partake of a past or a future by its instantaneous nowness, mm-hmm. and yet is at the same time multiple because it is also implicated in a past and the future that we can't have time with without being in.
Right.
It's both those things at the same time. It's complicated, but so. But temporalization by its very nature satisfies these two conditions. Indeed, it is clear that I am not the author of time.
Mm-hmm.
Any more than I am the author of my own heartbeats. You see what I mean? I'm already in it.
Yeah. But that's, you know, I'm not the passive recipient of heartbeats either.
I'm not the passive recipient of them either.
I am them.
I am heartbeats. Exactly right, yeah. Nor am I the one who takes the initiative of temporalization.
Mm.
I did not choose to be born, right? I'm thrown, right? Mm-hmm. And no matter what I do, once I am born, time flows through me. And yet the springing forth of time is not a mere fact that I undergo. I can find in time a recourse against time itself. This happens in a decision that I commit to, or in an active conceptual focusing. Time tears me away from what I was about to be, but simultaneously gives me the means of grasping myself from a distance and of actualizing myself as myself. What we call passivity is not our reception. This is the empiricist position. It's not our reception of an external reality or of the causal action of the outside upon us. That would be empiricism.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, right, reception of an external reality or of the causal action of the outside upon us. It is being encompassed, a situated being prior to which we did not exist, that we perpetually start over and that is constitutive of us. The spontaneity that is acquired once and for all, and that is perpetuated in being as the result of being acquired, mm-hmm. is precisely time and precisely subjectivity. It is time, as Andy just said. Mm-hmm. Since a time that did not have its roots in the present and therefore in a past would no longer be time at all, but rather eternity. So this is similar to when he says that, how does he put it? Time is not for someone, time is someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the same sort of way. And so what is it? Synthesis of transition. It's this weird, I don't know, aboutness.
Yeah.
Hold on. Or the sort of motor activity, or intentionality in the world, which is at the same time, I like this a lot, but it's really tricky. And I actually, I was with it, and then I wasn't with it, then I was with it, then I wasn't with it.
Because
there is a way in which he's saying that, yeah, we're in time. But we can't say it like the river, you know, as if it were some sort of objective time out there in some way. But yet we know that something of some kind is going on, and I'm in it. And what is this going on?
Yeah.
Well, we could make the mistake of thinking the going on doesn't have a past or a future because it's just now. And that wouldn't be right either.
Right. But the past and the future aren't here.
They're not here.
In the same way that what's here is here.
Yeah, they aren't. Yet, I can't have time without them being here.
Yeah.
In some way.
Right. So it would be false to say that it's now, that it's dark outside right now.
Yeah.
That's just false.
Yeah.
And yet what it is outside right now is unthinkable without relation to it becoming dark later.
Yeah.
So it's to suggest that daylight is not the transition into night would be to misunderstand what day is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what I want to just point out two things really quickly, just for people's reference, which is one, that he reminds us again that we're talking about synthesis of transition on 443. And in these passages that Pete has just read, it sounds like he's talking about, in a positive way, about a passive synthesis. And we had argued at the beginning that passive synthesis is what the empiricists say, and it's wrong. And active synthesis is what the intellectuals say, and it's also wrong.
But the passive synthesis here is the Husserlian, is Husserl's passive synthesis, which is the transitional synthesis.
Right.
So
he there's two kinds of passivity.
Yeah. There's
the passivity of the empiricists, where everything is outside of everything else, where there's external causation. What do we call part extra part earlier in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Then that kind of passivity has no place. But the passivity of being in and being encompassed by is in fact the passivity of the transition. And so in that sense, we can refer to the synthesis of time as both passive
and transitional. Transitional. Yeah.
But we don't call it an active synthesis, I guess, because it is in a way active, right? Like, that's not false to say. But he never calls it an active synthesis, because by active synthesis, he seems to mean the Kantian position that we make time or we constitute time. And, he's just argued against
this. This is why it gets really tricky. This is why I was raising the trickiness of it, because when he uses, you're exactly right, he uses passive synthesis in the way Husserl uses it, which is transition synthesis that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And he wants to show that, as he puts it in a certain way, that we are actively passive, and we are weirdly enough entirely active and entirely passive.
Mm-hmm. Because we don't choose any of this.
No.
We didn't choose to exist. Existence has us in its grip.
Yeah.
From that point of view,
it's encompassing. There's no.
Yeah.
And to exist is to be in time in the world.
Yes.
So
time is just just the most general style of existing.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it does not, it's true that time would not exist for something that did not exist. Right.
Yeah.
And it is true that if you imagine being without a point of view on being, you are now imagining something in which there could be no time, because time erupts from the rupturing of being's univocity with the subject thrown into it as a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And without a point of view or a perspective on the world, there's no time, and there's also no space.
Mm-hmm.
Time and space are And this is why I think Merleau-Ponty keeps coming back to the landscape, is because the landscape is a way of, the landscape we know is always from a point of view. You never forget that about landscapes. But our existence is a landscape. That's what we mean when we say that it's a milieu or a situation. We mean that it's always taken up from a certain point of view and not another. And so we can't get outside of time. And each of us is an instance of temporalizing. And that is what we are calling the passive synthesis or the synthesis of transition.
It's really tricky. I mean, it's this sense of our envelopedness. It's in and out, but I, after reading this chapter, I just hesitate to use the word now too loosely.
Yeah.
Because then you can make the mistake of thinking, you know what I mean? You can whittle away the past and the future again.
Right. We use the word now to try to talk about a point in time.
But there's no point.
Yeah, there is no point.
Yeah. But
Aristotle actually, you know, in this is maybe not so relevant for our class, but you'll remember this, that Aristotle, I was kind of confused about Aristotle on time because of all that stuff about the nows and the lines that he does. But this time when I was reading the physics through, I realized that he's actually quite clear. He says that the now as a point can only be talked about if you take a piece of time and cut it. And then the now is the is the point at the end of the segment.
Which is basically what when he picks up that diagram from Husserl, that's just what Merleau-Ponty is doing. Here's a cross section. But that's a fiction.
Right.
That no one can experience.
The now is not time. The now is like an artificial reflective construction that we use to talk about certain increments of time, and time doesn't actually occur by increments at all.
No.
Presence is a word that Merleau-Ponty is comfortable with.
Presence.
Yeah. But not now. Because now is like when you're trying to say, okay, now. And then this goes back all the way to we've been prepared for this for a long time because you were like, you know, these crazy 19th century psychologists trying to measure attention. What's the duration of a now? How many seconds does a now last? I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
What on earth are we doing?
It's a fiction. And as if it's a psychic state.
Right. As if it's a psychic state that we're in, that we are in a now. And I don't know. It's just ridiculous because
Or a brain state, or whatever they call it. Yeah.
The texture of pasticity and futurity is just woven into the texture of presenceosity.
Yeah, sort of flow ongoingness.
Yeah, they're all part of the same fabric.
Yeah.
And you get them all together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you can't separate them out into their parts.
Well, and this is why it's so difficult to talk about time.
Yeah.
With any kind of precision. Because when you're trying to be precise about it, it feels like it slips away. Precisely because most of the language that we have to describe it wants to fix it.
Yeah.
But fixing, I don't mean fix it like you fix a car, but fix it in time. Stop it.
Right. But of course, how would you capture time by stopping it when the whole point of time is that it's the passage of time?
Yeah.
So the very idea of making time explicit through freezing it is like trying to make the flow of a river explicit through freezing it. You don't make it explicit through freezing it.
No.
You can only make it explicit by talking about what it feels like to be in time. And I think
honestly, so synthesis and transition in a sense is that wholeness, that all of it in the flow of time.
And I think he comes closest to talking about what it feels like to be in time when he's talking about how, you know, the future, I mean, the evening is present even though I'm not thinking about it. Yeah, or someone's jealousy is present even though he thinks he's in love.
Yeah. Yeah.
The to come is just what's gonna roll out of the present. Given,
sometimes the easiest way to do it is to think about, rather in general than just my experience of a thing.
Mm.
I look at my coffee cup,
mm.
and well, that's my gaze.
Mm-hmm.
Is the making of the coffee in the morning and the anticipation of making the coffee tomorrow morning.
Yeah. Yep. When I get, I don't drink tea after 6 p.m.
Yeah.
Because it'll keep me up.
Yeah.
Like a little bit, maybe, I'm not sure, but as a rule, I don't drink tea after 6 p.m.
Yeah.
So, if I look at my teacup after 6 p.m., I feel like anticipatory joy.
Yeah.
Because I can't do anything about it now.
No.
The teacup has become an irrelevant object to me. I mean, I can drink non-caffeinated teas, and I sometimes do at night. But, like, the tea I really enjoy is mostly caffeinated. So, like, when I look at my teacup, especially if it's sitting next to, you know, Mo, look at Merleau-Ponty and the teacup next to each other. And I'm not gonna sit down and read Merleau-Ponty and drink tea right now, but I feel that anticipatory pleasure, which is to say that I am in the present, but I am very much in the future, and I am very much in time. And all of my moments of existence are all broken open to each other, so that you can't ever like put boundaries around them or separate them off. It's just like when you try to artificially separate from like a person. Like, let's say you had a really close friend for a while and then there's a falling out or a relationship that ends. The idea that you could just like demarcate that as like, oh, those were the peak years, you know, like, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
All the textures are interwoven. And so like, I look at the teacup and technically it's now, but it's also already tomorrow because I can't wait for that. That's what I'm living toward.
Yeah. Thus the self-affection of itself, as he says.
Yes. The self-affection of itself. That could have been another question that would have been, I think, rich and profound and interesting.
Yeah. Well. Andy froze.
Uh-oh. Oh, there you are.
There you go. We froze up.
Oh, yeah. And they say that time doesn't exist. It says my internet connection is unstable. It's accusing me of the problem.
Oh, well.
Hmm. Well, anyway.
That's a good spot.
It's a good place to stop.
Yeah. That was awesome. That was fun.
Yeah.
I think we kind of, I like that, you know, we sort of poked around in it and sort of found our way in it, which I think I hope all the students do too.
Yeah, me too. I think they will. They've been doing such great work.
They have. I mean, the stuff I've been reading has been stellar. So
I'm really pleased. Yeah. I think people are like, you know, you spend enough.
Yeah. Andy's locking up. We'll see if he comes back in, and then we'll end this thing up. I wonder if it'll just record me with him frozen, but not frozen in time. Oh, man. It's really appropriate.
Oh.
Oh.
Nope.
Wow, this is just really perfect in a lot of ways for this chapter. Anyway, so be good, y'all. I'm going to end it up there.
Bye, Pete.
Bye, man. Cool. See ya.